This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. A conversation's a conversation, right? Not necessarily. There's a lot that goes into a good, effective conversation, and it can have a profound effect on your success in business and life in general. Joining me this afternoon are Judith Glaser, CEO of Benchmark Communications, chairman of the Creating We Institute, and author of the book Conversational Intelligence, How Great Leaders Build Trust and Get Extraordinary Results. Also, Dr. Michael Stabile from Xavier University with the Department of Educational Leadership and Human Resource Development. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And thanks to both of you for being here this afternoon.
Well, thanks, Mark. Appreciate being here.
It's really great, Mark.
Judith, start off by telling us what the underlying principle of conversational intelligence is.
So many of us have thought of conversations as people talking at each other, talking with each other. A lot of telling is usually what has constituted most conversations that I've studied for the last 30 years, and not as much engaging. And we don't even notice it, and most of the time it's because we're so addicted to what we have to say and to being right and to launching into the conversation in a way that we start, that we often miss all the dynamics of conversations. So conversations actually take place at three different levels, and it's understanding the biological level or the neurochemical level, as well as the relational level, as well as the informational level that help people become really phenomenal at conversations.
So not all conversations are created equal?
You put the circle around the essence of what this is all about. Not only are they not equal, and they occur at so many different levels, and most of the time we've been trained to think about the words that we use, but words are only 7% of a conversation. And what happens that gets people into a tither when they're having conversations or get into difficult conversations is what Mike and I think about, which are the conversational cocktails that take place inside that we don't see, but we certainly feel when we're having a conversation.
So you talked about you get addicted to being right, so there's actually some kind of a neurochemical reaction that occurs with this whole thing?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing. We set up our schools that when you go to school and you get a good grade, then you get rewarded. As soon as you see that A, you get a dopamine high, you get adrenaline, you can't wait to brag about it, you can't wait to tell your parents about it. So we get excited about being right, and we get it in school, and then we go into work, and we get our bonuses for being right. So it's not unlikely that we would have a pattern of addiction that has been started from the time we were little all the way through to adulthood that engages us in conversation so we feel that high, because it certainly feels, I mean, it's like either feel good or feel bad, and if we have the choice, we're going to go for the feel good, and that feel good is that incredible addiction when you are winning an argument. And so that's what drives most organizations, not always to success, but that's what drives most organizations every day.
So you're talking about dopamine, I guess cortisol is another, maybe one of these chemical reactions you get. But on the other side, there's a reaction that you get when you do a conversation correctly, and that's what, oxytocin?
Yeah, I think you read my book.
Yeah, I believe I did. It's very good.
So what happens is when we're talking to somebody and we're addicted and the other person is shut down, that's when they get the flood of cortisol. They become frightened by trying to step up to you because the stronger you are, in many cases, it either causes people to fight with you or to shut down or to try to give in and move towards you. And so that's the cortisol that gets released that causes our brain to move away from being smart and intelligent and get into a fear state. And the other side of it, which is what we all love, is that it's dopamine and it's also oxytocin, which is the neurotransmitter that engages us further with other people. It's some people call it the bonding hormone, the love hormone. Michael, what are some of the other names that they call the oxytocin? It's the cuddle hormone?
Cuddle hormone, the hug hormone. Yeah. It's the feel-good hormone, you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, most of us want to have more of that. That's what drives us to each other. And so the more that we lay down our being right, the principle of being right, and the more we focus on other people's point of view and perspectives, the more oxytocin flows, and the more it flows, the more it enables conversations to become easier and deeper and more exciting, and it's the ones that we can't wait to have again. So there's an addiction on the other side, but too often we focus too much on the right side. which becomes the wrong side.
If you'd like to join our conversation on conversational intelligence, the phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mike, we'll talk about your involvement with conversational intelligence.
Well, Mark, you know, I've had the opportunity to be working with Judith now for a number of years, and obviously when conversational intelligence came out, immediately we kind of put some things together that I think would be helpful. I work with also not only my work at Xavier, but I also do some consulting work, and I have some groups that I work with. I have some business groups specifically that are in facilities management. And one of the things we're talking about is exactly what Judith just kind of framed up for you about how important conversations are. But what we're finding out in research is the fact that the higher people get up in organizations as far as role and position, the less EQ they have, emotional intelligence. And obviously, then that drops their conversational intelligence. So with this group of leaders, they've had the opportunity to meet Judith. They also have had the opportunity to read her book. And one of their biggest takeaways, which is kind of interesting, kind of like you, Mark, as you talked about reading the book, was they connected with it right away because they heard something that I think is a theme that Judith and I are hearing is we listen to reject, not listen to connect. And so we have to reverse that paradigm. We have to listen to connect. And as we do that, it changes the whole chemistry of conversations. So what we did with this group of business leaders, we did an assessment on them. And they were kind of shocked by it, but as they looked at their emotional intelligence, they recognized that doing this particular assessment, that they're average and below average in several areas. Now, they would assume that they were much higher as they started looking at their EQ, but it was much lower. And the thing about it is we said, we're not going to focus on what the assessment score says. We're going to look at how we can maximize ourselves by using conversational intelligence. So we did something very simple. We started saying, we're going to focus on that very simple axiom. We're going to listen to connect. So in the next 60 days, every conversation that you have, whether it's formal or informal, every meeting that you have, we want you to bring your attention to listen to connect.
And so I guess, Michael, what you're talking about is what Judith referred to it, I think, as I-centric and we-centric. Is that how you put it?
Exactly. When we're focusing on distinguishing ourselves from others' points of view, that's when we become very eye-centric. And very often we're thinking about, well, that's not what I was really thinking. So we're rejecting the other person's point of view before we even take it in and consider it. Exactly. So when you go to connect, you're actually focusing on another person's point of view first and listening to see how your thoughts and their thoughts come together. And I'll give you a sidebar on this, which is fascinating research also about the brain. Is that in very, like, 0.07 seconds, the brain is filtering out, is this person like me or not like me? And if they feel that the other person is not like me, then at the lowest level of the brain, we start to put up walls against the other person, getting inside of us and really connecting. So by shifting it from rejecting the other person's idea so you can get your idea in and focusing on connecting, we actually activate the part of the brain that enables us to feel like we are connected to you, to the other person. And again, at the lowest level of neurochemistry, it lays down a foundation of trust that's happening well below the level of consciousness.
Now, Judith, I've always heard that the first 30 seconds of a conversation are the most important, but you're saying it's actually, what, 0.07? Is that what you said?
0.07 seconds is
that's
the
amazing.
Speed with which the brain, this part of the brain, because it's so trained to, it's called like me or not like me, and it's a part of the brain right below the prefrontal cortex that has to filter that, because once it does, then it enables you to know what to do next. It's either the brain opens up or it closes down. And so it has to be that fast for us to navigate with others. Just think about animals. You know, they have that speed. Well, we have that speed, too. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Did Darwin have an influence on your research on conversational intelligence?
You know what? It's funny you should say that. That's like such an intuitive question. About 20 years ago, I remember saying, and I study Dharma. I'm an organizational anthropologist, so I look at the evolution of humanity and society and culture. But I remember saying there's so much emphasis that's being put on territoriality or survival instincts, which is what a lot of, it's a survival of the fittest that we would always hear connected with Darwin. But as I started to look at this, I said, and at the time I was writing a dictionary for Random House, and I said, I think there's a missing term here. I think there's another anchor for Darwin's thinking, and I don't know if it's in his work because I hadn't found it yet, but I said, what if it wasn't just survival instincts? What if we have vital instincts? And what if our brain at its higher level of development, not the animal part, but the prefrontal cortex, the heart, what we're human beings are evolving to, what if that was the instinct that was driving us? What would my theories look like? And for me, it was like one of the most profound days of my life, because once I drew that out, that was really my conversational dashboard. That's the arc of engagement. Well, on one side is survival instincts and protect, and on the other side were these instincts for the vital instincts for we and for thriving. And that was 20 years ago when the first framework for this book that we're all talking about, the framework of this book got created.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Michael, you were saying that you've been working with Judith for quite some time. How were you first exposed to Judith's ideas about conversational intelligence?
Well, Mark, I was in a bookstore, and I came across a book, one of her books called The DNA of Leadership. And it just resonated with me. I started picking it up. I couldn't put it down. Some of the seminal ideas there I was already applying, and the real concept behind it, he's written another book called Creating We, I started looking at that and applying it and teaching it. And it just so happened that we were at a conference, a mutual conference, and we met. And Judith, being who she is, doesn't go around telling who she is. She just has conversations with people, just as regular people. And she had a conversation with me at a breakfast one time. And it dawned on me about halfway through the morning sessions that this is Judith Glaser, the one I've been really taking a look at. So from that part, our conversations in conversational intelligence started from our interactions. So she's really been a good, great model of what conversation intelligence is all about, and picking it all up from how to create we with all that. So that's how it started with me and looking at it. And obviously the partnership has then grown as a result.
I have to brag, Mark, can I brag about Michael as well?
Okay, go ahead.
What I've seen in Michael Stabile is a courage to experiment with material. He first has strong instincts, and what he was realizing that both of us were trying to speak about things that in the world they weren't talked about a lot at that point, but there was an intuition that there was something better and bigger that was happening around us, whether it was in education where he's doing his teaching or whether it was in working with businesses. And he just dived in to experiment. And I think at the time that we met, I don't know, you maybe were up to about 50 different schools that you had been experimenting with in addition to the businesses that you were working with. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a lot of courage, but he stayed with it, and he has brought out of this work a lot of thinking that surrounds the application of this work in everyday life. So it's not just theory. What he's done is really cracked the code on putting it into practice and then watching the phenomenal results.
Well, Michael, what are some of the results that you have seen from the organizations you consult with using conversational intelligence principles?
Well, Mark, you know, as Judith was talking about that, I've really seen specifically having conversations with people that are doing – we do what's called 60-day challenges. We do a training session, and then we try to keep things simple. And that's one of the principles that we're looking at. Let's take some complicated things, but let's keep them simple, like listening to connect and so forth. What we're finding out is even we're going to be meeting again another training session in March. But within 45 days or so, people have been working on this listening to connect concept. And already, here's some of the comments that I'm receiving from them. I'm more in the moment with people. I'm turning off my electronics, and I'm looking people in the face in meetings or in one-to-ones and so forth. I'm more aware of my eye contact. I'm more aware of the fact of how my movements affect people. If I'm distracted, they immediately disconnect or I disconnect with them. Here's a very interesting thing, though. Although they're working on the business side and they're getting great results in their meetings, they're seeing things happen on the personal side. One father said, I'm becoming a better father as a result of this because I have teenage sons. And I found myself is I'm eye-centric in the way I treat them. I'm demand and control and realize it's not working with those teenagers. And as a result, he opened up to try to have what we call level 3 conversations with them, opened up the space to them, and instead of dictating, said, how can we solve this together? He said, it's been amazing results in only a short period of time. So a lot of things we're talking about, the application of them isn't where you have to practice them over long periods, but they can be instantaneous by just simply being aware, kind of like the illustration that you were talking about earlier in about reading the book and actually putting the application together. That's the uniqueness about that. You can put it immediately to practice, see tremendous results happen.
So there's a level one conversation, which is, your basic yes, no kind of conversation, maybe just trying to get a few facts out of someone. Level two goes a little deeper, and then level three is the deepest level of conversation.
Yeah, when you're looking at it from that perspective, is level one is pretty much I'm telling and I'm selling. Here's where it's at. Level two is I'm trying to connect with you, but I still have an agenda. I still am going to ask questions that I have an answer to. Level three, you're opening up the space. You're asking questions that you don't necessarily have an answer to. For example, when he did that with the boys, he's saying, hey, we have an issue here. How are we going to solve it? I'm not going to come up with the answer. We're going to come up with it together. It changes the whole dynamics and even the chemistry of how people react and how they connect with you, especially in building trust.
And Judith, I suppose that in the business world, most of your conversations are level one, maybe level two conversations?
I'm actually working with a number of really big clients right now, over 100,000 people in the organization. And I asked them to chart how much time they spend in level one, level two, and level three in the early parts of learning conversational intelligence. And people were coming back with their reports, and they had nothing in level three. They had a lot in level one, and they had actually, strangely enough, also a lot in level two, which is they started to realize out of this, and we hope for a level of self-awareness that grows out of this that Michael and I call the third eye. And what they start to realize is how much they're actually moving, pushing, defending their ideas in the world, thinking that that was a way to clarify their ideas for others to get it, but instead it was felt on the other end as really steamrolling people into buying their ideas and not being open. So that's just the measurement. Just building that kind of awareness opens up an extraordinary new way of thinking inside of companies. Like Michael said, it almost happens right away, and it develops an appetite for, okay, so what is level three? You know, we're all competitive. We want to know what we're missing. So, you know, what is level three?
And Mark, just to add on to that is that one of the things we're doing with this team is to be aware of when they go to level three conversations so that they know when they get it. So, you know, Judith's talking about the level setting concepts. You don't know it unless you've experienced it. What is a level three conversation? We can give you all the, here's what it is. But when you're there, you know when people connect and people are nodding their heads. And all of a sudden, there's a synergy in the room that changes everything. So we're actually having them chart when you go to level three. What does it look like? So they get the feel for it.
Judith, does conversational intelligence make it easier to have the difficult conversations at work that you might try to avoid otherwise?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's really fascinating is it seems to take away the negative electricity around difficult, because a lot of times difficult is in our heads as well. We are already set up when we're thinking we're going to have a difficult conversation. We're already set up to be about fearful and what are they going to say and how am I going to answer. And so we're already in a defending mode, which is level two, if we're playing it out in our heads. And so level three is something that is completely different, that opens up a space which is non-defensive. It builds, it takes the fear out, because as Michael said, you're thinking about the other person and you're asking questions that you normally wouldn't ask. And what we call these are questions for which you don't have an answer. So when we say to somebody, goodness, I wanted to speak with you about this particular topic, and I was really wondering if you could lay out for me what some of your thoughts are so that I can understand where you're coming from. And we used to think that that was soft language, let me find out where you're coming from. But we're now finding that these types of phrases that invite people to connect are phrases that just set the stage and open the door for easy instead of difficult to be what's present in these conversations. It's like finally somebody asked me how I was thinking and feeling is the relief that people talk about.
No, I guess I'd have to clarify. This is not about manipulating people in conversations, is it?
Mm-hmm. In fact, that's exactly what happens in level two when we're really strongly in level two. A lot of times the questions that we ask other people, we think that we're doing what's called advocating and inquiring. And inquiry, usually in our heads we would think, well, inquiry is asking what's on your mind. But when I actually observe, and again, I'm an organizational anthropologist, and I observe the quality of the asking questions or the inquiry questions, and too often it is manipulative. It's leading somebody on the bus, as they say, you know, how do we get everybody on the bus? Well, we ask questions to lead them in the direction that we want them to go. So don't you think it would be a good idea for us to consider putting more money in the budget for this type of marketing project? That's not asking a question. Mm-hmm. That's leading. That's manipulating. And we use it so much at work that people, unless they're brought to enlightenment about it, don't even realize how often that's the direction. And you're absolutely right. It's moving away from manipulation and really opening the space for discovery.
You know, Mark, Judith's point is a good one. And being a professor at Xavier, I found myself saying, I thought I was having a lot of level three conversations in my classrooms. Then I realized I really wasn't. At best, I was having level twos. So it really has changed the dynamics of the way that I approach my classes. Because when you have a level three conversation, the whole way that the operation of the class runs, it's not where people are directing all their questions back at you as the instructor, where they start talking to one another. And you see it, it's almost like a click switch that happens where they start really connecting with the other people in the room as a result, because the space has been opened up where there isn't about a right answer. And that's how we've been trained in school many times, is it's right answer. Same thing in business. It's about having a right answer. This is not right about a right answer. This is about opening the space up so we can explore and take away some of the fear areas that we might have to take risk, yep. Innovation, so forth.
Yep. Do we have time for one more little piece of neuroscience?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So what Michael's talking about is opening the space, and we've used those words a lot. What we now know is that when people move into level three and they openly respect each other's point of view, they're not arguing back and saying, well, this is what I meant and you were wrong and all those catalytic things that we often hear, but you're opening the space to appreciate another person's point of view. It opens up the prefrontal cortex, which is the executive brain, and the heart connection. And when the prefrontal cortex is open, it actually has inside it the capability to lay down new thoughts in a way that are neutral, lay down new thoughts that are innovative, not in the other parts of the brain. It's what allows this new thinking to emerge. And when that happens, you start to hear people say things like, well, what would happen if we tried it this way? Or what would happen if we looked at it this way? All of a sudden, they move from I to the we word and to thinking together, like what would happen if, and their brains are focused on the future. So when we attune leaders to listening for this type of shift, they actually have mastery over creating more space for level three to emerge. It's fascinating.
What do you think of do you think things would go better if politicians and government folks used conversational intelligence?
Oh my goodness.
That's a loaded question. It's that. Yes. Okay.
That's the next show.
Judith, is conversational intelligence something that you're born with this, or is it a skill that you can develop?
It's everyone's born with this. It comes from using all the capacity of our brain. But what happens is too often schools turn off that genetic code for these types of conversations. Turning off doesn't mean that it's off forever. It just means that it downregulates the capacity or the learning. And as Michael's excitement about using this in education, that we have the ability, and teachers and parents have the ability, to actually turn on the activity called conversational intelligence in the brain, activating it. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, there's not one person who's a human being that doesn't have this capacity. That's what's so exciting about this work.
It's exciting because I have grandchildren who are preschoolers, you know, or one is in kindergarten, and it's amazing to see that you can have a level three conversation with toddlers and preschoolers.
So start teaching them from an early age.
Very young, yes, because there is a response there, obviously, as you start looking at opening the space up for them. Because so much what happens in their life is being told what to do and how to do it. That doesn't mean that you don't have those. Certainly doesn't mean you don't have guidelines, right? But it means maybe sometimes we need to look at how we're approaching them in the language that we use, obviously, in the conversations that we have.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
It's been thrilling to be here.
A pleasure. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it very much.
Judith Glazer is author of the book Conversational Intelligence, and Dr. Michael Stabile is from Xavier University. Coming up, an exhibit in Dayton that honors the history and accomplishments of the men who played baseball in the Negro Leagues. And in Focus on Technology, Ann Thompson tells us about robots that are helping train Cincinnati and military medical personnel. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.